The headlines this hour. People in Turkey head to the polls in a historic presidential runoff between the incumbent Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the opposition leader Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Dozens of Israeli settlers, heavily guarded by Israeli forces, once again break into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and occupied outlets. And Ukraine reports fresh Russian drone attacks on the capital Kiev, while saying Moscow has eased attacks in and around the flashpoint city of Bakhmut. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. It's good to have you with us. Starting off with Turkey, people there are heading back to the polls in a presidential runoff that pits the incumbent Recep Tayyip Erdogan against the opposition leader Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Some 64 million people are eligible to elect the president for the next 5 years. Erdogan is seen as a favorite to extend his 2 decades of rule. He secured over 49.5% of the votes in the first round, narrowly missing out on an outright victory. Kılıçdaroğlu came second with less than 45% of the votes. Erdogan has also secured the endorsement of the third-placed candidate Sinan Ogan. Key election issues are the economy, earthquake relief operations, and refugees. Let's find out how things are going in Turkey. And from Istanbul, our correspondent Rashan Saglam joins us. Rashan, over to you.
Yes, Kahve, again, we are in another location. It is our third polling station here in Istanbul. Also, we headed west a little bit to give you an update on how things are going. It is more and more crowded as we are going through this electoral day and this runoff on a Sunday. Now it is 12 noon in Istanbul, and people are flocking to the polling stations, and the weather has become a little bit better and warmer here. Now, in Istanbul, as I mentioned, the people are more and more flocking to the polling stations. However, let me tell you that in Izmir, people are present in the polling stations, and more than ever, or more than the first round, actually. And I think that is due to people mainly supporting over there the opposition, and they actually think that they have this time a chance to make a change in the country and vote for the opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Now, we all know that Izmir is always a province that votes for the CHP, the Republican People's Party. This is a stronghold for them. And winning Izmir, usually the CHP wins Izmir, Ankara, and yeah, those are his strongholds, and winning Izmir is very important. But the most important is that the people who are supporting the opposition this time, they think that it's either this chance that they can get or none, because this is the first time that actually all the opposition political parties, or most of them, they agree on one presidential candidate. Usually in the presidential elections in Turkey, we have more than three candidates. However, this time we had only three, and now with the rerun we have two. So as I mentioned, the opposition had only this chance to maybe make a change and bring a president from the opposition. I also mentioned before that for the past 20 years, we have been seeing the AK ruling party having their president from Abdullah Gül to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. However, after 20 years, the opposition, they want to make a change and come back to ruling this country after 20 years. Now, today's election is, as I mentioned, very important, because whoever is going to win now, he is going not to only rule Turkey for the next 5 years, but also is going to rule Turkey for the next 100 years, next century. Turkey's age now, the Republican's age is the Republic's age is 100, and now everyone was talking about it, especially President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is that whoever is going to win the presidential election is going to rule for the next century of Turkey. Now, let me also mention, in Ankara, the presence in the ballot boxes of the voters is less than before, or less than the first round, unfortunately. People are speaking that in Ankara, there are no queues anymore, like the previous round. 2 weeks ago, we have been seeing people waiting in line to vote since 8 a.m. in the morning in Ankara, the capital. However, we are not seeing this today. There is no queue, and people are saying that The election is going today very calmly and smoothly and softly because maybe it has to do with two reasons. First is people maybe are not as enthusiastic as the first round. And secondly, I think it has to do because they now only have one election, which is only the presidential seat, not the, previously we had the parliamentary seat, and of course we had different political parties and alliances. So voters had to choose for two, the presidential election and the parliamentary election, and they had to choose between three different candidates, as well as different 24 political parties and five alliances for the parliamentary election. However, now they only have one paper with two candidates, so they only have to choose one presidential candidate that they would vote for. So I think that's why the vote is going smoothly and faster. And because it is going faster and smoothly, the High Committee of Elections said that the results would be revealed earlier, around 10 p.m. Turkey time, and they also said that maybe they will allow the media and will end earlier. Usually, as per the Electoral Committee, when the ballot boxes close at 5 p.m. Turkey time, at 6 they gather the ballot boxes from all polling stations, and at 7 the counting starts. Between 7 and 9, the media, of course I'm talking about media in Turkey, we as foreign media are not included, but the media is allowed to reveal any information about results. However, this time they're saying that since the approximate final, let me say precisely, approximate final result is going to be revealed at 10 p.m., the media ban could be able to share the results at 8 p.m. or before that. So the High Electoral Committee said that the ban will be lifted from the media before 9 p.m. as it is the usual. Now, of course, if you look at the people, there are a lot of youth voting this time. I have to mention there are 64 million people eligible to vote in all over Turkey in the 81 provinces. More than 6 million of those are voting for the very first time, who became 18 years old and are finally eligible to cast their vote. And in this round precisely, unlike the first round, some 50,000 youth who just got the right to vote will be casting their votes in this runoff. And usually, as we always mention, the youth will be voting for the opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. As they always say, they want freedoms, and this is what he promised them. He promised the freedom of speech, freedom of journalism, and general freedoms. Also, he said that he is going to protect women's rights and to protect women from domestic violence.
Thank you very much for that, Rashan Sağlam. We appreciate it. Rashan Sağlam, a correspondent there from Istanbul. Thanks. Moving on, tens of thousands of people have yet again for the fifth month flocked to the streets of Tel Aviv, protesting against the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial overhaul. The consecutive weekly protests have seen some success in that the plan has not been approved as quickly as Netanyahu had hoped. But it seems that the Prime Minister and his far-right cabinet remain committed to pushing through the changes, despite being under immense pressure both at home and abroad to scrap the plan. Netanyahu agreed to delay the overhaul to try to negotiate with the opposition a middle ground. But after shifting focus to pass the annual budget last week, the highly contested plan is again at the forefront. Economists have warned that an independent court system is crucial, that the plan would further isolate the Israeli regime internationally. Dozens of Israeli settlers, heavily guarded by Israeli forces, have broken into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied outlets and performed rituals there. This is not the first time settlers stormed the mosque, which is revered by Palestinians and other Muslims as an Islamic holy site. Since the year 2003, the Israeli regime has allowed settlers into the compound almost on a daily basis. Palestinians dismissed the settlers' presence at the mosque as provocative. Tensions have been running high between Palestinians and Israeli settlers over the latter's trespassing on the holy site. Israel captured East Al-Quds, where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is located, back in 1967. Mona Kandil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah to tell us more about this. Well, tell us what has occurred here and how many settlers are we talking about?
As you were saying, under heavy Israeli military protection, over 160 settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex this morning from the Al-Maghariba Gate, and then Al-Maghariba Gate was completely closed, preventing Palestinian worshippers and Muslims to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex for prayers. According to the endowments of department in Al-Quds, the Islamic endowments of Department of Al-Quds, 40 police officers also were accompanying those 160 settlers as guests, honor guests, raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. 30 students, Jewish students as well, and they unfortunately performed religious rituals inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. According to a statement, 2,230 settlers have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex as tourists and not as Jewish settlers. And this is the way it's being used by the Israeli authorities and by the Israelis. They claim that they are tourists. They are not entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex for the prayers. They try to hide the real identity. And however, when they storm the complex, they perform their rituals. We have to mention that the Israelis since Thursday were, marking one of their Jewish holidays that continued for 2 days, and Thursday and Friday. And during these days, every day, hundreds of Israeli settlers escorted by Israeli soldiers were raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. At the same time, Palestinian Muslims, their ID had been taken from them at the numerous checkpoints surrounding the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as well as in the old town of Al-Quds, preventing them from freely entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque to pray, at the same time allowing the Israeli settlers to enter the Muslim site.
Thank you very much for that. Mona Kandil from Occupied Ramallah. Thank you. Moving on, Ukraine says Russian troops have temporarily eased attacks in and around the flashpoint city of Bakhmut to regroup and to strengthen their capabilities. Russia says its forces have completely taken over the city, but Kiev says it still controls pockets of Bakhmut. The battle for the city has been the longest and bloodiest of the war. The capture of the city would bring Russia slightly closer to its goal of controlling the whole of Donetsk region. Meanwhile, Ukraine says it will soon launch a highly anticipated counteroffensive. Ukrainian defense officials say the push could start as soon as tomorrow, or ultimately by the end of the week. Ukraine says the offensive aims to recapture territory taken by Russia since the start of the war. Ukraine says at least one person has been killed and another injured after Russia unleashed a major two-wave overnight air attack on Kiev. Several districts of the capital, by far the largest Ukrainian city, with a population of around 3 million, suffered in the overnight attacks. According to Kiev's mayor, the raid was conducted by drones. He says air defense systems downed at least 20 unmanned aircraft. Moscow has intensified missile and drone strikes on Kiev this month after a lull of nearly 2 months, targeting military facilities and supplies. Tens of thousands of Serbs have taken to the streets of Belgrade in an anti-government protest over two mass shootings that killed 18 people. Crowds surrounded a compound housing the state broadcaster, calling for the resignation of the Serbian president. They also demanded more media freedom. This was the fourth such protest organized by opposition parties. They accused the government of failing to rein in media that have promoted violence and to act against criminal elements in society. The government denies opposition parties' allegations, accusing them of staging protests for political gain. On May 3, a young boy killed 9 students and a security guard in Belgrade in the first school mass shooting in Serbia. One day later, a 21-year-old man killed 8 others outside of the city. French police brutality against protesters continues to occur, and one group which knows plenty about that subject are the Yellow Vest anti-government protesters. They still gather every Saturday nationwide and do so despite regular harassment by police and judges. Rami Mazzari has more from Paris.
When climate activists were tear-gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris, The Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards nonviolent protesters. Many of France's yellow vests were glad the subject was reported upon, but the group which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout. Many were shocked this month when a woman who was not participating in a 2019 Yellow Vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries. The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find fault with the state's actions, seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely, and will likely scare many away from even observing a yellow vest protest. On June 6th, a million-person march is expected, the 15th this year, in the ongoing fight against a two-year hike retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st. Besides their Saturday marches, the yellow vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, May 28, 2023. I'm Atefer Fani, hosting this program today. As you may know, Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views and outlooks are presented through your emails, your letters, and your messages from around the world. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our programs. Please tell us which program or programs you like the best. And if you have any message for our great listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. As I always say, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program. And here we've received reception reports from around the world. From Maxim Mikhailichenko from Russia, Ayush Kumar Das from India, and Mate Holosi from Hungary. So, Maxim, Ayush, and Mate, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. Thank you for the reception reports. And of course, we've received many emails and letters from around the world, which I mentioned some of your names here. And later during the program, I will read these emails. From Brazil, we've received an email from one of our old and regular listeners, from Robens Fras Pedroso. Ayush Kumar Das from India has sent us an email. From Hungary, we've received an email from Mate Holosi. From India again, we've received an email from Sia. And the last but not the least is an email from Italy from Maurizio Vecchi. Stay with us, please. I will be back with these emails. Welcome back. So as I said, from Brazil, we've received an email from Robens Fras Pedroso. So let's see what Robens says. Hello, my dear friends. I hope you're doing well. I'm sending you more reception reports from Brazil. I would like to receive your station's QSL card if possible. Until the next contact, all the best wishes for all. Salam and warm greetings to you. And thank you very much for this email. I think in Brazil, which is located in southern hemisphere, the weather is a little cool. It's cooler than what we are experiencing in the northern hemisphere. So why don't you tell us about the weather and your experiences in your country, Robens Fras Pedroso from Brazil. We would be glad to hear that. Anyway, appreciations to you for the reception reports you send to IRIB English Radio, as well as your email. My colleagues will soon send you an electronic QSL as confirmation, Robens Fras Pedroso from Brazil. Anyway, we wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And of course, we are waiting for more emails and messages and your views about IRIB English Radio. We wish you all the best, Robens Fras Pedroso from Brazil. From India, we have an email from Ayush Kumar Das. Ayush says, dear sir or madam, I want to say that the reception report is enclosed to this email. Please find and issue a QSL card or EQSL to verify them. Also send me some new programs guide and some beautiful postcards. I hope you will send me a letter soon as possible with a new QSL and picture postcards. Thanks and best regards. Salam to you from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Ayush Kumar Das from India. Please accept our warm gratitude to you for this email. For your information, sending any material on behalf of IRIB English Radio at the current moment is not possible, so please accept our electronic QSL or EQSL as confirmation to your email. And you can find our programs guide and the frequency guide at our website at parstoday.ir/en. Anyway, we wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon, Ayush Kumar Das from India. And after a short break, I will be back with you. So let's see what Mate Holosi from Hungary says. Mate Holosi is one of our old and regular listeners. Mate says, Dear IRIB, I'm writing to you in order to share my reception report from the city of Debrecen, Hungary. Reception wasn't the clearest at the start of the program. At the beginning, the program was clearly hearable. I'm a regular listener of your radio station. Your radio station helps me to get to know more about your country. If you think that my report was helpful and you liked it, I would very much like a QSL card sent to my address. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran to Mate Holosi from Hungary. Please accept our warm appreciations to you for this great email. Thank you very much for letting us know about the trouble you had regarding the quality of the reception. But don't worry, please. Because our technicians and engineers will fix the problem about the quality of the reception if the problem is on our behalf. We are so happy to receive this great email from you, Mate Holosi from Hungary, and we are glad to hear that IRIB English Radio is a good source to get to know more about the Islamic Republic of Iran for you, Mate Holosi. Thank you. So write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. Mate Holosi from Hungary, thank you. Again, from India, we've received an email, this time from Sia. Sia says, Dear staff, I will be grateful if you send me a QSL verifying my reception report enclosed to this email. Please send a letter or a card where you include a specification that I have really heard your station. I will thus have an evidence of having heard your station here in my country. Your QSL card is very important to me. Thanks. Salam and greetings to you, Sia from India, and thank you very much for this email. Of course, Sia from India, we will send you an EQSL or electronic QSL as confirmation to your email. We wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon, and we are waiting to hear more about your views about the broadcast of IRIB English Radio. Sia from India, thank you again. And after a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. From Italy, we've received an email from Maurizio Vecchi. Maurizio says, Dear friends of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, here is my report on reception of Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran. I would appreciate if you can check out your station log. If my report is correct, I would be grateful to receive in return your station QSL card with the time, date, frequency of this report mentioned on it. The broadcast in English and the presenter was talking about Iran's news, a country I love. I've been there 3 times and I would like to travel again anytime. Thank you for taking time to read my email from Italy. Yours sincerely. Salam. Greetings to you. Ciao. Maurizio Vecchi from Italy. Please accept our appreciations to you for this email. My colleagues will soon send you an electronic QSL as confirmation to your email. And you mentioned that you've been to Iran 3 times. That's so great. So, as a suggestion, Maurizio Vecchi from Italy, why don't you share your experiences of your journey to Iran with our, great listeners around the world? We would be very glad if you could share your experiences in your upcoming emails about your being in Iran and your journeys to Iran, because you said you've been in Iran 3 times and it's great. So let us know your experiences in Iran. So Maurizio Vecci from Italy, write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. We wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. So we had a really great time together, and saying goodbye is hard. So before saying goodbye, I do send my warm appreciations and gratitudes to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports as well as emails and letters, including Maxim Mikhailochenko from Russia, Ayush Kumar Das from India, Mata Holosi from Hungary, Robens Ferraz Pedroso from Brazil, as well as Maurizio Vecci from Italy and Sia from India. Please keep in touch with Listeners Special and IRIB English Radio and tell us your views about our programs. We wish you all the best. God bless you and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Protests in Europe are continuing unabated. This time, thousands of teachers and healthcare professionals have taken to the streets in the Spanish capital, Madrid, demanding better pay and working conditions. This can be applied to other countries in Europe, like the UK and France. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether European governments have efficient economic game plans when it comes to resolving their citizens' problems, or will they blindly support the Ukraine war, which has been one of the factors that has led to European economic miseries. First, let me introduce our correspondent from Brussels, Jerome Hughes, who joins us to give us the latest on this. Well, Jerome, you have another strike action, and protests, I should say, were combined. Perhaps you can tell us this happening in Spain, and I believe also one in Italy. Give us what you have on this.
That's right, Covey, and many more planned as well, because we have record high employment in the EU, which is a good news story. The problem is there are far too many poor quality jobs, so you have a situation whereby lots of people, millions of people are on the minimum wage. The minimum wage is certainly not keeping up with very high inflation, and workers are sick and tired. Just because you have full employment, it doesn't tell the full story. The situation is that the cost of living crisis continues to be out of control. You have inflation higher in some EU member states than others, and you have a situation whereby people cannot pay their rents, cannot pay their mortgages. just a few days ago, the European Central Bank celebrated its 25th anniversary, and Christine Lagarde was there cutting an enormous cake. And on social media, she received scathing criticism because people are saying that these people at the top of the tree, earning huge salaries, they're completely out of touch with ordinary people who are struggling to heat their homes at night when it does get colder, even at this time of year, and also struggling to put food on the table. Interest rates keep going up, inflation remains very high, and we have the situation whereby we have the latest figure, €65 billion has been sent to Ukraine from the EU alone. €65 billion.
All right, thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. Jerome Hughes there from Brussels, a correspondent. Thank you for that update.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight now. Clive Menzies, political economy researcher and analyst, joins us from London. And Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joins us from Brussels. Welcome to you both. Gilbert Doctorow, let me first start with you. We are looking at protests that are happening on a weekly basis at a minimum. Some of the countries that we are seeing the protests occur in frequently are places like France and the UK. Now we're looking at Spain, which is not obviously their first time people coming out to protest involving teachers and healthcare professionals, the one we're looking at. But what is your assessment when you keep hearing and witnessing these strikes that are happening in Europe? In this case in point, we're looking at Spain and also Italy to be the latest.
Well, the strikes are about different issues in different countries. There is a commonality of cost of living crisis across Europe, but that has not resulted in a commonality of strike movements and protest movements. In France, the protests have been enormous, but they were about a local issue, a French issue of raising the pension age. You've just remarked on strikes of teachers and health workers in Spain. That again is a local issue that is driven by the local conditions. Here in Belgium, we had strikes this past Monday. I don't know that your journalists were aware of it because they were strictly a local issue, but they brought out four of the largest unions in the country, and all of the public transport in Brussels was greatly disturbed, if not shut down, as a result of strikes. For what purpose? The strikes were about the changeover by one of the largest supermarket chains in Belgium, Delhaize, who are disposing of their assets and franchising out their 100 or plus stores across the country. And this is protested by the labor unions because the new franchisees are going to change the work rules and compensation and so forth. So the whole protest was about what's called social dumping. But the point I want to make is that the commonality of the problem, which comes across the EU from the very poor judgment of the leadership of the EU countries with respect to the war in Ukraine and the imposition of sanctions, which are self-destructive for the economies of Europe, that is not a cut up across the board in any of the countries. So the not to mention the fact that the threats and the risks to peace and security and to the survival, indeed, of these countries if the war expands as it's on a track to do, that is not discussed. We're living in a fool's paradise, and that is terribly regrettable. That I see no opposition movements of any kind to the inevitable evolution of this war from a Ukraine-Russia war to a European-wide war.
Okay. Clive Menzies, I'm sure you have a deep analysis on this, you know, when you take a look at a country like Spain, I have to group that, well, I don't have to, but I want to group that with Italy and France in terms of the debt that they're carrying. It's quite high. Greece is the number one, but Italy, 147.3% of the GDP, then Portugal, and then Spain, 115.6%, and France, 113.4%. The reason why I'm putting these countries together and ask you as to, the fact that this is not about just the Ukraine war. Prior to this, you had COVID-19, and prior to that, you had the countries that were struggling. And, of course, we can go back to the 2008 financial crisis, where we haven't really looked at the countries recuperating from that economic mess back then.
Indeed. Good evening, Kelly. Yeah, undoubtedly, we were predicting at least a decade ago that we were heading for some sort of disaster, and we were pretty public about it in the city and elsewhere from about 2015. And a lot of this is driven by money supply. There is a massive oversupply of money in the major economies, and that there is a price to be paid for that. And we're also seeing the final throes of plunder. In the UK, the amount of money that is being harvested off individuals, groups, sections of society for driving, for all sorts of things. Plunder is full on. We said last year we're heading into crazy times. We're now in those crazy times, and it is all driven by money. But it is actually, we do have a way out of this, and we also have the building blocks already in front of us. But maybe I'll come back to that later.
Okay, yeah, definitely we want to hear what those building blocks are. All right, so Gilbert Doctor, you talked about the Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. I'd like to find out from you if you can tell us whether the EU is actually living almost at the present when it comes to their energy supplies. The reason why I ask that is back in December of 2022, von der Leyen, the European Commission President, said, "We have managed to withstand Russia's energy blackmail with our RE Power EU plan to reduce demand." She talked about 300 billion euros worth of investments. The result is that we are safe for this winter. So that's for the winter of 2022. But when you take a look at what's going to happen for 2023 and then the next winter after that, Europe as a whole does not have enough energy reserves, if I'm correct to say that. And they're kind of go as they plan, or plan as they go. I'm not too sure what the phrase is. Are they aware what they're dealing with when they're supporting the Ukraine war as they have been, as to what they're dealing with in terms of maybe coming up short with energy and how disastrous that would be?
Well, even the Financial Times and articles in the last couple of weeks have dealt with this issue and have come up with the findings that, yes, Europe has saved 15 or 20% in its annual consumption of gas, and how wonderful that is. And yet, in 2023 and 2024, they still will be required to import 10, 20, 30%, oh, well, not 30, but 20% of their gas supplies from Russia by one means or another. Still, the issue is not whether they can heat houses. The issue is whether they can maintain industry. Despite the fact that, yes, they covered the needs and the population did not go cold in this past winter, partly thanks to a mild winter, the fact remains that industry began moving out of Europe. This was most notable in Europe's largest manufacturer and exporter of industrial goods, Germany. The Financial Times, again, is a very useful source because they are not interested in showing crisis. On the contrary, they're interested in showing stability. And they have remarked on how the German Mittelstand, the medium-sized family-owned companies, are moving to Switzerland and to Sweden because of the high price of energy in Germany. Now, the larger companies are moving to the States. Bayer Leverkusen announced maybe 6 months ago that they are disinvesting in Germany and moving production capacity to the States, where energy is cheaper. There are whole sections of industry which cannot maintain a competitive product in the environment that we have now and are likely to continue to have, even if Europe's leaders say they are covering the needs, not at a price that industry can afford. The glass industry is one, metallurgy is another. This all has an impact on jobs and on the population at large. But the single biggest issue is not power right now. The single biggest issue in the cost of living problem and deterioration of living standards is in food. Again, 2 weeks ago, the UK reported that food inflation for the past year has been on average 18%. That is average. In given food categories, whether it's dairy or vegetables or whatever, if it goes up to 50% or even 100%, this is something that the average working man feels every time they go shopping. And it takes out of his pocket an important amount of money that otherwise would go to enjoying life. Here in Belgium, my wife is a member of a women's club of professional women, retired women, but women who have had comfortable lives by their husband's income and by their own income. And they are complaining around the dinner table that they're shocked at the prices here in Belgium, and still more shocked when some of them who have relations in London and go back and forth visit the UK. This is something that wealthy people are complaining about and poor people are suffering from at a great deterioration of the living standards.
Okay. All right, let's go to the building blocks that you talked about, Clive Menzies. Go ahead.
Well, the thing is, before the adoption of money, we operated on the basis of knowing and trusting all those within the community with whom we dealt. Money was a very useful mechanism to deal with people outside the community where you didn't have access to data. There wasn't a means to understand what those needs and capacities of those communities were. However, we're now in the age where companies like Google, Amazon, eBay, Microsoft, Facebook have got huge volumes of data that are analogous to the sort of data that we used to carry about who was buying what, who was friends with who was good at what. All of that information is now being stored. The only difference is it's being monetized. If we open source that big data, then we don't need money. And most of these problems that we see that result from competition would switch into cooperation, and we'd live in a world of miraculous abundance. Now, that sounds like utopia, but if you bear in mind that the current system works in direct contradiction to our interests, what our needs and capacities, what we need to fulfill our capacities to be able to do things, has nothing to do with money. Money has a completely separate valuation that causes conflict and causes wars and competition and all the rest of it. We have the building blocks to change the way we live, and it could happen very quickly because the power of the internet is making transformation at record speed, and more people are looking at this idea of, instead of focusing on money, let's focus on the data. And if you look at Amazon Fresh, you walk in, you walk out, okay, money changes hands at your bank account. But what is most important in all that transaction is the data about people, what they can do, what they need, and we can satisfy everybody's needs. We have more than enough resources in the world to feed, clothe, house everyone more than once. And all we need is a different system, because this one clearly doesn't work and it's breaking. And if we don't think of something different, then more and more people are going to die, more and more people are going to suffer hardship, and the problems that your other guests referred to will just continue.
Sure.
We just need to think differently.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, I think that has actually happened, Gilbert Doctorow, the whole thinking differently process. I think the WEF back a couple years ago talked about this transformation that needs to take place. And, of course, green energy has been something that's been propelled. Well, the U.S. seems to have taken a leading role. But given what has happened with the energy crisis, which stemmed from, in one sense, from the Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, countries are reverting back to the old sources of energy, so it's not having that impact. And based on this particular source that was researched for this program, when it comes to the fact where we talk about protests, it says protests over food and fuel surged in 2022, the biggest were in Europe, which has continued in 2023, and it blamed soaring energy prices, whereas to contrast to a decade ago, it said food prices were to blame. So this transformation has fallen flat, right?
I'm afraid I don't quite follow your question.
Well, the transformation that they've talked about hasn't happened because you have an energy crisis, the thirst for energy, and to go green is not. It seems like the infrastructure is not really in place, but countries' economies need to. Move. The wheels need to be in motion. So they're reverting. They're not really moving away from oil. They're going back to coal countries like China, I could even say. And therefore, this whole green transformation is not happening. I'm trying to relate that to what Clive Menzies said in terms of the new approach that needs to take place.
Well, the green movement has made enormous traction in the last couple of years. And, of course, the attempts to cut gas consumption has been a factor here in the last year in the new enthusiasm of the population at large for placing the electric or heating generating panels on roofs. And the whole public is deeply involved in discussing it at home and with friends. At the same time, I can tell you that here in Belgium and in Germany, I know from colleagues there, that the price of firewood has doubled and tripled in the last year. So not only are we not going back to coal, but people are heating their homes with firewood. Now, you tell me, please, is that progress or is that a reversion to energy sources that we thought had long been abandoned?
Okay, so Clive Menzies, the protests that happened in Spain, it was reported to be in the tens of thousands. I believe it was 70,000 to 120,000 altogether. You had maybe less numbers in Italy, but you had some of the biggest that have happened in France, where it was a million months ago. And you have these protests. I think Belgium was in the tens of thousands also, if I'm correct.
Yes.
When is the time where you think that, and the fact that Gilbert Doctorow, our guest in Brussels, said that the food problem is really at an elevated state at this point, where people are feeling the pinch of the rising inflation of food. When do you think that threshold is going to pass, where people are going to say enough is enough, and that governments are going to feel threatened in order for them to have to react?
Well, I'd say the die is already cast. From what I see locally and around the world, is more and more people waking up to what the Great Reset and the Green Agenda are all about. The carbon reduction they're talking about is people, and people are awakening to that, and they are making alternative arrangements. And so when does this happen? I felt that the tide turned in 2022. There is a rising recognition of the corruption, the criminality, the outright genocide and greed that is just taking place in plain sight. The fact that it's not reported in the main media doesn't really matter, because in social media it's gaining ground. The truth resonates far more strongly than the lies, which need constant maintenance. So I think we are in the beginning of a major seismic change of the way human society operates. And the Great City, the Great Reset is analogous to Stalin's five-year plans, the Chinese cultural Great Leap Forward, where they are genocidal plans which never work. And people are aware of that, and they're working locally, creating alternatives for health, food, knowledge, information, all sorts of things. People are beginning to help each other rather than relying on the criminal institutions that are now so blatantly greedy and looking to harvest every cent, dollar, penny, euro that they can get their hands on. So we're in crazy times, but new things are emerging, and that is what news programs like this one ought to be looking at, because that's where the future is, rather than the sort of final death throes of a dying system.
Okay, thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. That's Clive Menzies, political economy researcher and analyst from London. Thank you. And Gilbert Doctorow, thank you so much. Independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. We had Jerome Hughes, a correspondent from Brussels, at the top of the program. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Yacoub Itapwe and the team. It's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan.
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.